a way to constructively derive the holographic duals starting from boundary field theory. This is a little bit different from the main topic of this conference, but hopefully there is some overlap. So according to the ADS-CFT correspondence, D-dimensional quantum field theory is dual to one higher dimensional theory that includes quantum gravity. And we know that there are many non-trivial checks for some supersymmetric gauge theories. Let me just point out that this correspondence is believed to be a general framework, not just for some specific supersymmetric gauge theories. But so far, there is no first principle derivation of the conjecture. So we don't have a way to construct the holographic duals for a given field theory. So, however, we have a qualitative understanding why holography might work from holographic RG. So according to the correspondence, if I have a boundary D-dimensional field theory, then we can turn on some operators, say O, and then we have some space-time dependent source. And then the extra dimension in the holographic description plays the role of the length scale of the system. And then one can think of the beta function of these sources of the field theory, namely, as we lower the energy scale, how the sources change. And then the beta function of the sources can be identified as the on-shell solution of the fields in the bulk. Okay?
So the beta function is not really always meaningful, right?
Yeah, so that's actually that's the next point. So this this identification is meaningful only in the large n limit. Because beta function is in a sense always a classical object, namely for a given initial condition or given sources, you have a unique solution in the bulk. However, in holography, we expect that the bulk fields are quantum in general. So there are quantum fluctuations in general. That's why this identification is meaningful only in the large limit. So although this gives some idea, we need more general framework that works for general n. So the question that I would like to address in this talk is the following. Can we explicitly construct quantum theory in the bulk, namely a quantum theory of gravity starting from a boundary field theory? So if we can do this, this will give us a way to identify gravitational dual explicitly for some quantum field theory that we want to understand that originates, say, from condensed systems. And this kind of construction will give us the microscopic justification for the ADS-CFT conjecture. So the goal is to start from a concrete quantum field theory and then construct the bulk theory from a first principle construction. Okay? And then the bottom line is that one can think of quantum version of RG, quantum version of the beta function. If the conventional beta function was a classical one, we can think of quantum beta function, and then we can identify the quantum renormalization group as a quantum gravity. So hopefully this this statement become clear at the end of the talk. Okay, so first, let me give you the basic idea without going the details. And in particular, I will try to highlight what quantum RG, quantum renormalization group, means. And then in the second part, I will show you the explicit construction of Borg theory for a concrete matrix field theory. And here we will see that the Borg theory is indeed a quantum theory of gravity, and the basic ingredient is the usual Riesenian RG and also the induced gravity. And I will also discuss about the origin of the diffeomorphism invariance in the holographic description. And we will see that diffeomorphism invariance is nothing but the freedom to choose different RG schemes in the RG. Okay, so let's start from the basic idea. Suppose I have a d-dimensional field theory, and then the partition function is given by a functional integrations of d-dimensional fields. And then J's are space-time dependent sources that we can turn on. So here N labels different operators, and J's of N is a source for that operator. And then the partition function is a functional of these space-time dependent sources. Okay, for example, for scalar field theory, I can turn on some source for the energy momentum tensor, or I can turn on some space-time dependent source for the mass term, etc. Okay. Now, in RG, usually what we do is to divide the field into the low energy mode and high energy mode, where the low energy mode has a UV cutoff, which is slightly smaller than the original cutoff, say lambda. Here, dz is a small parameter that parameterizes the energy scale. Okay? And then the high energy mode is defined within a thin share in the momentum space, for example. So in conventional RG, we integrate out the high energy mode, right? Then we get some effective action for the low energy field alone. And this low energy field is coupled with some renormalized couplings. Okay? And then the change of the couplings as a function of scale gives us the beta function, or beta functional in general. Here, we do something else. So we first note that if I have low energy mode and high energy mode in my theory, we can view the high energy mode as dynamical source for the low energy mode. For example, suppose I have some phi to the nth coupling in my theory, and then I can expand this action as a power series of the low energy field. And then the coefficient or source for the low energy field is made of the original source, capital J, and also the high energy field. This is because there's a coupling between high energy mode and low energy mode. And then from the point of view of the low energy field, the high energy field plays a role of source, but this source is not a constant anymore. They are dynamical. In this sense, I can interpret high energy mode as a dynamical source. So I can rewrite the same theory as a theory of low energy field, which is coupled with coupling, which is made of the original coupling and some correction coming from the high energy mode.
So this is just a rewriting.
Yeah, this is just a rewriting.
You haven't integrated it.
Yeah, I haven't coarse-grained it yet. Okay. So this is just an observation. And to make this more explicit, we can introduce some auxiliary fields. We can to decouple the low energy mode and high energy mode in the following way. So we introduce a pair of auxiliary fields, J's and P's, So here one means I'm working on the first step of RG. Then I have auxiliary fields for every operator that I can turn on. Okay, and in general, these J's and P's are space-time dependent fields. So here, the low energy field is coupled with this dynamical source. Small j is a fluctuating source that is coupled to the low energy mode. Okay. But we know that this source cannot be arbitrary. This source has to be constrained to be this source, the original source plus the correction from the high energy mode. And that constraint is imposed by a Lagrange multiplier, say P. So P is a Lagrange multiplier. So if you integrate out P, you get a delta function for small j. And then if you integrate out small j, this small j get replaced by capital J plus the correction coming from the high energy mode. Okay. So this is just the same action as I have here. At this stage, this auxiliary fields, J's and P's, does not have any dynamics. They don't have any action. So they are not propagating mode yet. However, if we now integrate out the high energy mode at this stage, then this high energy mode generate some non-trivial action for this auxiliary field. Okay. So then the high energy mode is gone. Then I have a theory for the low energy field. Okay. And then low energy field is coupled with dynamical source, small j. And then quantum fluctuations of this dynamical source is controlled by an action that is generated out of this high energy mode. Okay.
Did you expect this to be a local action? Is this going to be a local?
Yeah, so in general, it's not going to be local action, but if you choose the high energy mode have only very short wavelength fluctuation, then integrating out high energy mode generate only correlation that is exponentially decaying in real space. So it's local in that sense. You can do the gradient expansion. Okay, so we have a theory of low energy field couples with dynamical source. So this is the first step of RG. Now we can repeat these steps. For example, we now focus on this field, okay, and then divide this field into low energy mode and high energy mode, and then decouple the low energy mode and high energy mode by introducing another set of auxiliary fields, J2 and P2, and then integrate out the high energy mode, and it generate another action for J2 and P2, and so on. And then you completely integrate out the original field. And at the end of the day, your partition function can be written as a functional integration of this dynamical source, J, and its conjugate field, P, introduced at each step of RG. And step of RG runs from first step to infinitely many steps. Okay. And then one can explicitly write down the action for these auxiliary fields, P's and J's. So here I indicated that this action is a D plus one dimensional theory because J's and P's are, first of all, depends on D dimensional coordinate of your field theory space. But also it carries another index L. This L is the step of RG. It's a discrete index, but we can make this dz infinitesimally small, dz being the change in the length scale or energy scale. And we can make this dz very small. And then we can take this step of RG very large. Then this extra dimension becomes continuous coordinate.
So you have written it suggestively so that now it looks like sort of a canonical part.
That's right.
Okay,
that's
and right. Hamiltonian, whatever, maybe
right.
In some
that's right.
Euclidean signature, whatever,
right.
But who cares?
Right.
But if you go back to your transparency, the first step, actually, that which you call H, actually, I'm sorry, the fourth step, right?
Okay.
Yeah. What you call H actually is made out of S and delta S, right?
No, this S
I'm
is
sorry,
from
delta
the
S.
delta
The
S is
delta S
delta is the
is really the H.
H, right? This delta S is kind of H times dz.
So that would kind of make sense from the point of view of Hamilton-Jacobi, right? If this delta was to be viewed as some type of it's a variation to some conjugate time, it gives you the H. Is that what you have in mind? Yeah, okay.
So here J, physical meaning of J is the, of course, the dynamical source. And P is kind of dynamical valve or operator. This
Why can't we disentangle such that the delta S doesn't depend on F, a low energy moment? Phi, why delta S doesn't depend on low energy moments? Why does can you disentangle your effective action after integrating
So,
high frequency modes in such a form?
why is that delta S does not depend
Yeah,
on low
on
energy mode?
why you can disentangle your action in
Right.
this way.
That's because here, from the structure here, the low energy mode couples only with this dynamical source. So I'm kind of separating the low energy mode and high energy mode. And then low energy mode is coupled with this dynamical source. And then high energy mode is coupled to this auxiliary phase, but not directly.
Okay.
So low energy mode and high energy modes are coupled with each other through this auxiliary phase. So that's why if you integrate out high energy mode, you generate action only for this auxiliary phase. Okay.
Now, you're calling this Z next stack coordinate, but I would say what you have is a continuous parameter.
Right.
And you have to show that this coordinate is on the same footing as the other coordinates, that you can rotate one into the other if
Right.
you're.
Yeah. So I will come to this point,
Okay.
how this d plus one dimensional coordinate respect, say, d plus one dimensional diffeomorphism
Yes.
layers. Right. Yeah, that's important question. So for now, diffeomorphism invariance is not manifest. They are
So
like
when
a
you have this a continuous
it's
parameter.
like a foliation of your d plus one dimensional space and time into sheets of d dimensional space.
As well, why is your action this? Why is it infinitesimal? H times dz.
That's
Why?
because of the fact
Delta
that the high energy modes are defined only within thin shell. So if you integrate out those high energy modes, at most you generate some action that is infinitesimally small, linear in dz. Okay. Then this first term basically becomes like a very phase term, like x dot coordinate derivative of coordinate with respect to this z times the conjugate momentum. And it's very convenient to interpret this z as time. Then in your or in your
Or evolution parameter, not time.
yeah, it's not real time. Real time is along the boundary. This is some fictitious time. Then there's a quantum operator, and this operator is a generator that governs the evolution of this coupling along this scale. And it's not constant anymore. The key point here is that these couplings, J's, are not constant. They are operator in a sense. That's what I mean by quantum RG. I'm talking about dynamical couplings and then dynamical valve. And there is a quantum operator that governs the evolution of those operator.
Is this some Legendre transform you've done? Is that what you're doing
It's not
here? Are you like dividing it up into energy level and then doing some sort of Legendre transform for each little portion of the energy level?
it's kind of a change of variable from the original field into this dynamical sources. It's not just a Legendre transformation. It's
No,
a
no, no, I understand. But for each little energy wedge,
yeah.
is it a Legendre transform?
Yeah. So
Well, in a sense, yes, because you have introduced conjugate pairs, right? P
and
is
you're getting
J, not
exact
conjugate.
terms for
Yeah.
both.
To make a Legendre transform, you have to solve the integrate either out P or integrate out of
Yeah, if you
G.
integrate out P, then you get
Then you
some
get an
action
effective action which
with
is
two derivatives.
self-dependent. Other way
Yeah.
around, you get an effective
expectation, yeah, which is p-dependent vacuum expectation derivative.
Yeah, so this
they
is
related by the general.
Yeah, so if you have an action with two derivative in Z, you can map into this form by introducing this canonical momentum. So this is usually the Legendre transformation. But this is kind of Hamiltonian formalism.
Well, here in your argument was important that you use large N.
It's not, so large N comes later. This is general. So large N comes in. So large N determines whether these fields are weakly coupled or not. But this, at this stage, there's no need of large N. This is general,
and
general change.
Do you use sources for all bases of operator algebra of the theory?
Yeah, so here,
you see in ADS CFT, only sources for single traces.
Yeah, I will come to that point.
Single particles.
Yeah, this is just a, just to give you a rough idea. I will, in the second part, I will discuss the explicit construction for the matrix field theory. In that case,
there is a different way of
the same
derivation which you did.
Yeah, so yeah, that's right. So you can introduce more redundant fields, but you don't need to. You can introduce only source for single trace operators. That's enough for matrix field theory.
So one more question, sorry. Where did the capital J on the left-hand side go in the right-hand side?
That capital J is imposed as a boundary condition.
G0.
So here.
Thank you.
So it's kind of Dirichlet boundary condition. So here I have a D dimensional field theory and I have some fixed source, right? But as I integrate out high energy modes at the expense of introducing some auxiliary fields. And these auxiliary fields are introduced at each step of RG. And these auxiliary fields are dynamical source and dynamical operator that fluctuates independently. So it's like a full partition function is given by summing over different paths in D plus one dimensional space. And then these variables are source. And then the original information about the theory is imposed by this boundary condition. Okay, so here, this is
Can you just go back? The UV was down.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's say, is it like this heat kernel method in some sense? Is it like a quantum version of heat kernel? Well,
for the RG.
So you know,
because RG,
how you divide it?
RG is just the
sure
heat equation. Yeah.
Sure, but isn't that? I mean, is this what this is? It's like it's a sort of half integral derivation of the sort of heat kernel methods. Is that?
Just for the RG.
Yeah. So I think only difference is that here the sources are dynamical. It's not. So only difference from user conventional RG is that in conventional RG, whatever regularization scheme you use, you have a beta function. And then sources are not dynamical. There's no quantum fluctuations of the source. You give initial condition, then you find a unique path for.
But you have to do this right if you introduce VEVs as the conjugate. And your J's have to be dynamical if your VEVs are the conjugate.
VEVs are.
I mean, VEVs are the momentum.
Yeah, VEVs are. Yeah. So
if you really want it dynamical, I mean, if you want this picture where VEVs are dynamical, then the coordinates are dynamical. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So yeah, that's right. Yeah. If you have if Hamiltonian is a trivial, like if H does not depend on P, then P is just a Lagrangian multiplier, then dynamics is trivial. But in general, the Hamiltonian has non-trivial dynamics.
I mean, people have tried to do this in the past, like this guy Dolman, right here, the Irish guy. Anyway.
Yes, I'm not only here. Okay, so this is an exact change of variables. as I said, the original d-dimensional partition function can be mapped into d plus one dimensional function integrations for dynamic resources and their conjugate fields. And this scheme is very general. It can be applied to any field theory. Of course, whether the holographic theory derived in this way is useful or not is the next question. And that's where the large N comes in. But what I'm saying is that this prescription itself is general enough to be applied to any field theory. Of course, for general field theory, the bulk degree's freedom will be highly quantum. So it will be more difficult to use the bulk
description. It's not clear, for example, that there is a geometric interpretation.
Right, that's right. If it is highly quantum, then there's no classical geometric interpretation.
If we just take a free field theory, like non-interacting massive Klein Gordon, so what would this d plus one dimension say?
I imagine it's a highly quantum theory, or you need to, yeah, I haven't considered those field theories.
Nothing will happen. You see, he adds sources which include fields of high power. So if you integrate them out, the presence of the sources is crucial, and they bring interactions.
Mm-hmm.
It's not only clear that there's a geometric interpretation, it's not even clear that this way of writing it as D plus one dimensional theory any better or any simpler than the original theory, right?
Right. Usually it's much more difficult than the original theory. Yeah. So it's only for a particular set of theories that this kind of language is useful, in particular some large N matrix model. Large and matrix field theories.
So one more question, since you got interrupted anyway. So I agree that at this level, you may not have a classical geometric interpretation.
Right.
Can you at least see that the dual theory has gravity in some form, maybe highly quantum, but a graviton?
Yeah, that's the second part.
There is a symmetric tensor field among the surfaces.
Right, right.
But so, it doesn't have appropriate number degrees of freedom so far.
Yeah, so far, yeah. But I will show you that. So the original partition function can be written as a overlap of a wave function for sources. So this wave function is a wave function for d-dimensional space-time dependent sources. You know, this is a d-dimensional space and time, and then this is an additional fictitious time, say imaginary time. And then partition function is given by overlap between this initial state for sources and some final state determined at the infrared. And then there is a operator, Hamiltonian-like operator, that governs the evolution along the scale. And then partition function is given by this way. So this H is this H. Hamiltonian for.
You are doing something more than the Sonnier normalization group.
Yeah.
The Sonnier normalization group just fixes you the boundary values of the sources. And you are somehow have to fix as well the values of either of the sources or waves in the infrared.
Yeah. So, that's another good point. So, here we have we have only one set of boundary conditions, right? But we have J's and P's. So we need another boundary condition to uniquely find the, say, saddle point solution. And that another boundary condition is determined dynamically. So we integrate over all possible values of J's and P's, and we let the system to minimize the action. And that's usually equivalent to saying that we require that action is regular in the infrared limit. So that's the second set of boundary conditions. Okay. One can think about the Heisenberg equation for quantum couplings, the coupling operators. Right? It's not coupling constant; it's a dynamical coupling. And we can think about the Heisenberg equation of motion, and that's what I call quantum beta function. Okay, so as I said, in the field theory, there is an energy momentum tensor which carries spin 2. And there is a source for energy momentum tensor. And this source becomes dynamical in the bulk. So bulk theory always have spin 2 mode in the bulk. But does this mean that the bulk theory is a gravitational theory? Okay, so we need to have the right number of modes. In particular, we need to have the diffeomorphism invariance. And the key question is what is the origin of the diffeomorphism invariance? And does the bulk theory have the right constraints?
No, I don't think this is, this is like a minimal, I think you can't just look at the spin 2 mode. I think that, if you've got there's this Weinberg-Witten argument, right? That if you have a spin 2 mode and it's interacting, then diffeomorphism guarantees that you have gravity. But if you've got an infinite number of operators, which I assume you have, then is it really enough to...
No, I'm not saying this implies this. I'm trying to say that this property emerges.
It's not a bound state, so I think you violate one of the assumptions of one move. This will emerge if it does. Right.
Do you have the Witten-Weinberg theorem in mind that the graviton cannot emerge as a bound state?
I'm just wondering whether diffeomorphism invariance applies to all the fields. It's not just that you want a spin 2 degree of freedom to.
So what I'm trying to say is that
everything's got to transform correctly under different conditions, isn't it?
What I'm saying is that there are spin 2 mode in the bulk, and there are d plus 1 constraints, and they are first class constraints, and that's what I'm heading.
But if you do a diffeomorphism, then all the other higher spin fields also have to.
Yeah.
Transform correctly under that.
That's right. That's right.
So it's not, you can't just look at this spin 2.
Yeah, sure. So there are other higher spin fields as well.
There's an infinite tower.
Yeah, infinite towers of them.
And they all going to transform
correctly. So that whether they transform correctly or not will
be. It's the key question.
It's the key question. And then mathematically.
Infinite number of
mathematically, that question translates into the question whether these d plus 1 constraints are first class constraints or not. If they are first-class constraints, that means these constraints generate some kind of local symmetry.
You see, first of all, nobody say that these higher spin fields are massless or etc. It may be that you have diffeomorphism invariance in some truncated situation.
Oh, I see.
And in fact, there are higher spins of much more general form than in the CF series. They correspond to young tableaus of more.
Yeah, in general, most of those higher spin fields are indeed gapped. There's no protection for them to be gapless in the bulk. Okay, so in order to see that there is a diffeomorphism invariance, actually we have to generalize the RG scheme to what I call local RG. So in the first part of the talk, I mentioned this RG scheme where the cutoff, UV cutoff is lowered. And in particular, in usual RG, the UV cutoff is lowered uniformly in the same rate at all points in space and time. But you don't have to do that. There are freedom to choose different speed of coarse graining at different points in space and time. So that's what I call local RG. So suppose I have a UV cutoff, say this has a mass scale in the higher derivative term, it's like a Pauli-Villar regularization, and this is a UV cutoff. And then we can choose the RG scheme where in the first step of RG, say, we lower the UV cutoff in a space-time dependent way, in such a way that low energy mode has new UV cutoff lambda prime, which is x dependent. Okay.
So how would you define this x? Wouldn't this just get in the way of diffeomorphism invariance?
So I haven't discussed the diffeomorphism invariance yet. I'm just saying that in the RG transformation, when you coarse grain, you have a freedom. And the freedom is to choose different speed of RG at different point in space and time. And then the key point is that this alpha is a speed of RG, and then my theory or partition function is independent of this alpha. Okay, because this is just my choice of RG prescription. No matter what prescription you choose, you have the same theory, therefore you have the same partition function. This is by construction of RG. And this will be important to, therefore, there will be some constraint. When your partition function is independent of those parameter, this is like Lagrange multiplier in your theory. So there is some constraint. Okay, so this is one parameter family of freedom that I can choose different speed of RG. So it's like when you construct your bulk space and time, you don't have to lower your UV cutoff uniformly. You can proceed faster here than here, so that you can create. You don't have to foliate in a straight sheet. You can foliate your sheet in a curved way by choosing different speed of RG.
This amounts to thinking about the boundary theory. This is boundary theory on a non-uniform lattice.
Right. Yeah. And then second of all, in usual RG, if we do real space RG, we divide the field into high energy mode and low energy mode, and we assign same coordinate for the low energy mode and high energy mode. But again, we don't have to do it. We can give different coordinate for the low energy mode than the coordinate of the high energy mode. This is, again, our freedom. Okay. So in other words, as I go to lower energy scale, the coordinate of the d-dimensional coordinate of the low energy mode can be shifted relative to the coordinate of the high energy mode by some infinitesimal amount. And this is this can be done because, as I said, under the in this RG construction, the sources are dynamical. So in particular, the metric, d-dimensional metric, become dynamical. So there is a manifest d-dimensional diffeomorphism invariance. It's not d plus one dimensional diffeomorphism yet, but
you have to still show that there are the constraints, right?
Hmm?
You still have to show us how you get the constraints.
Yeah, I still have to see that. But what I'm saying is that, as I said, the small j, the sources for operator become dynamical, right, under this construction. Therefore, energy momentum tensor is coupled with this dynamical source, which is nothing but dynamical metric. So d-dimensional metric. Therefore, there is a d-dimensional diffeomorphism invariance. Therefore, you can choose whatever coordinate you want in the d-dimensional slice.
Your cutoff has to be consistent with the d-dimensional diffeomorphism.
Right, yeah.
Is it if you choose this kind of local?
Yeah, that can be done. I didn't explain here in detail, but I'm just giving you the flavor what is going on. Yeah, so this cutoff can be chosen in a consistent way, and then this n is like the shift. You can shift this foliation at lower energy scale relative to the foliation at high energy scale independently. And this n is a d dimensional vectors. Okay, and again, the partition function is independent of this choice of coordinate for the low energy mode. So this will give another d constraints.
So suppose, can I ask a question? Suppose you took the original theory, which was defined by Wilsonian action,
right,
and for some reason decided to put it on a fluctuating background.
Okay.
Like a fluctuating lattice, as well as this.
Mm-hmm.
Then you decide to do something which is not consistent with Wilsonian approach.
So what?
You integrate out the modes that you put in a fluctuating background.
Integrate out the quantum field in the
right
presence of fluctuating metric.
Right.
Right.
Now you get an effective action that looks at the diffeomorphism invariant from
right
the point of view of the d-dimensional theory.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But the theory, the effective action that you get is highly non-local. There's no separation of scale in which.
I mean, if you...
In other words, it's not an effective
field theory. It's not a Wilsonian effective field theory.
You
have to take all terms at every step, whatever question you ask, you always have to take all terms into account.
Yeah, so
because you're integrating, you know, you're integrating stuff that is massless as opposed to
depending on the background metric.
Right.
And then
depending on the background.
And then if metric is fluctuating for some configuration of metric, your field may look massless, then it will generate some non-local term, right?
Right. So you get diffeomorphism invariant in D by taking this dynamical lattice.
Right, right.
But you have done something which is a no-no from the Wilsonian RG.
Right. So in general, indeed, the bulk action in D plus one dimension is not local in general. And locality is feature of some set of field theory. So for some, say in the large N, and if you have some strongly coupled field theory, then in that case you have some saddle point background metric under which you have a sense of locality that you can define. So I'm not saying locality is guaranteed. Locality is something that emerge for certain set of field theories. So in general, it's indeed non-local. Okay. And then diffeomorphism is nothing but different ways to different choice of RG schemes. So you can choose different speed at each point, and then also you can choose different shift at each slice. And then by choosing different speed of RG alpha and different shift, and you can create different mesh in the bulk space and time. And then the key property is that the partition function is independent of these parameters, alpha and n. Therefore, this alpha and n are Lagrangian multipliers. Right? It's like whatever you compute is independent of the prescription of RG. This prescription, alpha and n, are something you choose. It's not something that is generic in your theory. Okay, so let me discuss the concrete example. So here, let's consider a D-dimensional matrix field theory. So I have a D-dimensional field theory, and then phi is n by n matrix fields. And I, for simplicity, I took n by n traceless symmetric real matrix field. It's one of the simplest matrix fields you can think of. And then here, O represent single trace operators. More accurately, it's a non-descendant single trace operators. Therefore, any operators can be written as a linear combination. Any single trace operators can be written as a linear combination of these and derivative of them. It's like primary single trace operators. And then J's are space-time dependent sources again. And then in general, we can have multi-trace operators that is non-linear in single trace operators. So this is the field theory. And then we can go through these steps. So for the matrix field theory, we can do the following. So again, in the first step, we introduce a pair of auxiliary fields for every non-descendant single trace operator, J's and P's. And then here J plays the role of Lagrangian multiplier that impose the constraints that P equals to this single trace operator. Right? Then in this original action, every O can be replaced by P. So here the single trace operator O get replaced by 1P. And if I have double trace operator here, then I have P squared here. In this way, we remove all double trace or multi-trace operators. And then I have only single trace operator, which is coupled with dynamical source J.
I guess I don't really understand why. So in the original picture, you were integrating out in energy and then doing this procedure, but now you're integrating over traces?
Yeah, so.
Is this supposed to be a derivative?
Yeah, so you can think in this way. First, I have a theory which has only single trace operator. And now suppose you integrate out high energy mode in one step of RG. And then after integrating out high energy mode, you generate double trace operator. And now you can introduce this auxiliary fields to remove the double trace operator. And order is different, but it's conceptually the same thing. And then in that sense, this dynamical sources and conjugate field get generated out of this high energy mode. Okay, so here the key point is that if you have a double trace operator in the beginning, whether it was there from the beginning or whether it has been generated out of integrating out high energy mode, it can be removed by introducing this auxiliary field. And then you are left with only single trace operator, which is coupled with dynamical source. And in particular, this dynamical source includes spin 2 metric and higher spin field, etc.
What is this small f?
Yeah, so yeah, let's not worry about this. This is some detail. This is some, I can choose different background metric, and you need some transition function that relate operator defined in one background metric into operator defined in another background metric. But it's kind of technical detail. Okay, and then now we integrate out the high energy mode and we use the local RLG scheme. We lower the UV cutoff in a space-time dependent way and divide the low energy mode and high energy mode and integrate out the high energy mode. And then this integrating out high energy mode does three things. First, this high energy mode is coupled with this background, this fluctuating background, fluctuating sources, including fluctuating metric. So if you integrate out the quantum field in the presence of some curved background, you generate action, a la Sarov's induced gravity. Mm-hmm. So this includes some cosmological constant and also d-dimensional Ricci scalar and higher derivative term, etc. But this is only d-dimensional Ricci scalar, right? We don't have the d plus one dimensional theory yet. So where are the other components? So the other components is generated from so-called the beta function. So now you integrate out high energy mode and it generates the Casimir energy, but also it gives rise to quantum correction to single trace operator, and also it generates double trace operator. So I have single trace operator here, correction to the single trace operator, and then it generate high energy mode, generate the double trace operator.
So my point, I guess, is that this effective action that you're writing in Paul-Sahara, I guess, yeah, induced gravity, is not a Wilsonian action. Because there's no separation of scales, right?
There is. So for a given set of background metric, you can lower your UV cutoff by infinitesimal amount. And that gives the small scale that you can use to expand your action.
George, for the fixed background, which is like very smooth, like contain depends only on low frequency modes,
yeah.
You can integrate up to a scale which is higher than that one.
I know.
Then you have separation of scales.
I know, but the coefficient, but
okay,
let's not.
That is, yeah. In any case.
Yeah, maybe George is worried about, say, highly fluctuating background metric field. Then in that case, it's not clear. But yeah, so
but in
general.
Always generically in this case have the high fluctuations.
Yeah, so that's why in general, this bulk action, this action is not local.
Yeah.
It's only in some large and limit where your metric has some smooth set point solution. In that case, you have some separation
actually,
of scale.
I'm not sure if it's large and limit. Maybe conformal invariance would be more crucial. But let me you
proceed. Maybe both. Both. If you don't have large end, you have large fluctuations of the source. Then
I don't think for QCD this action is going to be local. But anyway, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you need both large end and maybe strong coupling. Yeah. Okay, so I have double trace operator, and then if you have a double trace operator from the same logic that we discussed here, we can introduce another set of auxiliary fields to remove the double trace operator, and see what happens. The double trace operator, if I have a two O's here, then it gets replaced by P squared term. And then P is kind of a conjugate field, as we saw before. So P is like, if I have a G mu nu for D-dimensional metric, then I have a P mu nu or pi mu nu that is conjugate to the metric. And then this double trace operator generated from quantum correction provides quadratic term for pi mu nu. So this is like a kinetic term for the metric. So there is a potential term and kinetic term, and potential term is generated out of this high energy mode, and in the same way the gravitational action is generated in induced gravity. And then this kinetic term, pi squared term, is the consequence of the beta function. Even though you start from single trace operator, if you integrate out the high energy mode, it generates double trace operator, and double trace operator become p squared term, the quadratic term for the conjugate field. And then you can follow through the prescription, and then the Borg theory is given by the functional integrations of this d plus one dimensional field. In particular, there is a dynamical metric, d-dimensional dynamical metric, and then conjugate field, pi mu nu. And then the Borg action looks like this. So again, z is like a image, some fictitious time. And this first term is like a canonical term that says this j's and pi's, or g mu nu and pi mu nu are canonical conjugate to each other. And then the remaining term is like Hamiltonian. And the Hamiltonian is made of two parts. The first is term that is linear in alpha, where alpha is the speed of RG. And this is a D plus one dimensional field because you can choose different speed at different location. And also you can choose different speed at different scale. So it depends on X and Z in general. And then H is what is called Hamiltonian constraint. And there is a potential energy like term. This is just the Casimir energy that we discussed. This is a d-dimensional Ricci scalar, and this is a cosmological constant.
I don't see that you are integrating over alpha and then mu.
Yeah, I'm not integrating out alpha.
But why do you call this as a constraint?
Because the partition, so it's like choosing one gauge by fixing alpha and n. But the key point is that the partition function is independent of choice of alpha and n.
Where does it follow from that it is independent?
It follows from the fact that alpha is just the speed of RG. So I choose.
In the sense, it's like explicitly dependent the way you are writing.
Yeah. So it looks depends on alpha, right? But by construction, we know the partition function is independent of these parameters, because these parameters are just.
I'm not sure that I can formulate the renormalization group in a way which is renormalization scheme independent, because like in principle.
What I'm saying, usually beta function depends on scheme, right?
Yeah.
But partition function is independent of scheme. That's what I'm saying.
Hopefully, but
no, it's by construction.
By construction.
Where does it follow from? Do you know any construction, like for example,
you can get
renormalization scheme independent on higher loops than u?
No, you have a field theory with some.
You derive the RG equations by demanding the partition function.
Is it dependent on the renormalization group scale, but not
yes.
the scheme?
It is also independent of scheme. So you have a theory with cutoff, right?
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, to get the partition function, you have to integrate out all modes. But you can choose to integrate out this mode first and that mode later, and you can choose this mode by
but
you can choose
you
different
see,
speed
if,
of.
If you will look, for example, to Polchinski equation in the solenoidization group,
yeah,
it is derived under the assumption that nothing depends on lambda. But it is explicitly dependent on that
no, the,
function
the
k,
full
which is generalization group
and,
scheme.
And that's where the scheme comes in, okay? But
how can you get rid of that dependent?
The full free energy is independent of that scheme.
Yeah,
I would
be happy that it is true.
Yeah. Yeah, it is true. Yeah.
Well, if you say that.
Yeah, so and then the second term is the term that is linear in n, that is the shift, and then this h mu is the momentum constraint, and then you can explicitly derive that the momentum constraint has the y form that we expect from gr. And then key question is whether these d plus 1 constraints are first class or not. So and by the way, in the Lagrangian limit, the action is explicitly proportional to n squared because there are n squared degrees of freedom. And these j's and p's, pi's are all singlet. Therefore, in the Lagrangian limit, they are classical. And then one can define the equation of motion. And then one can define the Poisson bracket in the standard way. And then here's the point that this partition function is independent of this speed of rg and then the shift. That's why it is independent of this alpha and then shift. That means these are indeed constraints. They vanish on share. Okay? And then they are also first constraint because this equation is satisfied at all time in Z. I can look at this independence at different Z. And then if you take another derivative of this with respect to this imaginary time, then you get the Poisson bracket between different constraints. And then the fact that this vanishes for any choice of the speed of RG or the shift means that this Poisson bracket also vanishes on share. So they are classically first class constraints. OK, so let me summarize that. There is a prescription to construct D plus one dimensional holographic theory starting from a boundary field theory. But this is true for any theory. But for most theories, this is not very useful. But in some Lagrangian matrix model, for example, this description is useful because the bulk degrees of freedoms are classical. And then the key ingredients to have diffeomorphism invariance is a local RG scheme where you change the length scale in a space-time dependent way, and also you can shift the coordinate of the low energy mode relative to the high energy mode. So I think the quantum gravity by Maldacena is made of two ingredients. The first one is the Wilsonian RG, and then the second part is the Sharoff induced gravity. Thank you for your attention.